And open a public hearing on House Bill 4123. We're going to open this up to take some legislators' testimony, and then we're going to close it back up and do some other business and get back to it as the last item of business. I think we'll be moving pretty quickly to that anyhow.
4123.
Representative, senators.
Yeah, that's 4123, right?
Bates here.
This is generally Senate time, so we're 10 minutes late.
This is the representative. This stuff's not easy, is it?
On time, so Bates is expected.
Let's go.
Co-chairs, fellow representatives on the Healthcare Committee, for the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, and I represent House District 46. I'm honored to introduce House Bill 4123, Toxics Disclosure for Healthy Kids Act, and to welcome my colleagues from the Senate and other partners who are here today to advocate on behalf of this bill. As you know all too well, we are spending an enormous amount of time looking at how to transform our healthcare system to improve coordinated care for Oregonians, with a special focus on better managing the care of the 20% of the population who consume 80% of the costs, often due to chronic diseases and disorders. We are also transforming our education system from birth to 20, with a huge focus on how to better coordinate support for children who are at risk due to health factors, learning disabilities, ADD, and autism, among other factors. While I'm honored to work on these bold initiatives, I firmly believe that we also need to focus our attention on how to prevent the occurrence of chronic diseases and disorders wherever possible. Because of the growing scientific evidence that demonstrates that chemicals are contributing to an epidemic of chronic diseases and disorders, House Bill 4123 will help the state track where the toxic exposure occurs in children's products in one, two, three ways. One, designating a high priority chemicals of concern for children's health list. Two, publishing on Oregon Health Authority's website this chemical list with information on potential health impacts of exposure. Three, requiring manufacturers who have an annual revenue of over $5 million and who sell children's products in Oregon to disclose chemical information on those products, as is currently done in several other states. I now yield to my colleagues from the other chamber and look forward to discussing this bill later this session. Thank you.
Doctor.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Senator.
Co-Chair Greenlick, thank you. And members of the committee, thank you, Representative Kenny-Geyer, for inviting me to testify. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Stein-Hayward. I'm a family physician, president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and the state senator from District 17. As a family physician, I'm all too aware
And my constituent.
And your constituent. And your state senator.
Yeah.
And your neighbor.
There was not a sign.
It's very friendly in our neck of the woods.
I know.
You know, I'm really aware that multiple factors play a role in determining onset of chronic and acute illnesses. We know that poor nutrition, sedentary lifestyles, use of tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs, genetic predisposition, and lots of other factors come into play. That being said, we've become increasingly aware of the role of environmental and chemical toxins. In particular, we're concerned because we know that the earlier in life one is exposed to these toxins, we can dress you up.
I'm causing a sensation here by spilling water.
Thank you.
That's what you see is going on.
Yes, I saw it happen, but I wasn't going to comment on it.
It's not toxic.
I'm sorry, Liz.
Oh, it's colored. It must be toxic.
It's a good way to confuse any issue.
There we go. We're all good. Anyway, we know that being exposed early is the most problematic, so we want to protect our most vulnerable members of our community by helping their families be aware of the toxins that are in these products. We know that childhood cancers have increased 20% over the last 30 years. We know that more and more people are having other kinds of cancer, that asthma is rising, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, we don't really know what's in the products that our children are using. I don't know many people, myself included, who really understand what I'm reading when I see the names of all these chemicals on the shampoo that I buy for my kids. And I think as a parent, I'd like to know this. As a family physician, I'd like to be able to tell the parents of my youngest patients where they can look to get information so they can make informed choices. It'll be useful for the state. It'll be useful for our children. And in the long term, we hope it'll reduce our health care costs and help our state be healthiest. Thank you very much for offering me this opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Kenemer, and distinguished members. I'm Senator Brian Boquist. I represent the 12th District, which is five rural counties and six voters down in Lane County that are just across the bridge from Harrisburg. The reason I raise that up is that in my district, you know, I used to be the largest seed producer in the nation and in the world. Thanks to this legislature, always here, I'm not that anymore. But the issue that comes down in my district where you have trees and you have farmland is water. And we've all heard this before, and actually, I sat down with Representative Kenny Geyer. She invited me to come over and talk about several other things, and we talked about this bill. And we kind of started down the discussion of water, gray water, and other issues that impact a lot of rural Oregon. And from that, it kind of led to a discussion in terms of this bill, is, you know, where would a starting point be? What would you do? All of our bills start out as discussions. I've carried the Willamette River water bill for every session I've been here. It was carried for four sessions by Lane Shuttley before that, two sessions by Mayhew before that. We still never passed that bill. And I don't think we've got across the floor three times, but we haven't passed it. What you have coming around to you is part of that discussion and part of the bill 4123. I have being distributed right now the actual State of Washington printout from the Washington Department of Ecology, which is the mirror bill, very similar to what we have right here. And it lists 65 chemicals that they publish and put up on their webpage, and the work's already done for the 65 chemicals. The second thing that they have there is a single-page document that says, I guess, formaldehyde. And, Doctor, you probably know more about formaldehyde than I do.
Altogether too much.
Altogether too much, right. So I only watch the movies and the embalming things, you know, and I'm on the Committee of the Dead where we have the mortuary bills, and so I get this on my committee. But this particular piece of paper that come around really is an extract of another document coming down, which is a material safety data sheet. And that's kind of the crux here in the discussion we had that I had with the Representative Kenny Geyer, is that most of the chemicals that are out there, most of the products that are out there that are in the public sector already have a material safety data sheet that exists. And the question I was asking her about was if we started at the state level and said, okay, we already have the MSDs that are required to turn them into ODOT and every state agency known that we budget for, we already have a starting point for collecting data in the state. And we're always arguing gray water, can't take water out of the Columbia, point source, non-point source issues, and things like that. And maybe what we could do is take something like 4123 and as a starting point look at the state itself and say, okay, why don't we start tracking this? We want the farmers to do it, and we want industry to do it. Why don't we start proving it to ourselves, because we in the legislature control the state government, and identify in the state, for example, these 65 chemicals, and what is the MSDS, and start doing it and lead by example on our side, the state government side, and start going down that road, that direction. Because if we on my side want to get water, we got to save the fish. If we on my side want to cut trees, we got to save all of the other species that are out there at the same time from chemicals and everything else. And this 4123 is a good starting point for the discussion of saying, where do we go and why don't we lead at the state level? Before we totally drag in all of the private industry. Now, probably, I know the good representative wants to pass the bill and send it across the floor, and I wish her the best of luck. But like I said, I've been after that Willamette water bill for like ever. So I'd be happy to take questions, and I'm supportive of some of the concepts that the good representative has brought forward. And I'm delighted that you at least gave a hearing and you're able to, you know, look at the issue and we can start discussing it.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. You know, I have a question about, there are some items excluded as children's products, and are you the ones, or will there be someone else that would be better to maybe answer that later?
Yes.
Probably someone later.
Right.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions in this panel?
More of a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I've worked with Representative Kenny Geyer to try to understand the scope and purpose of this bill, and one of the things that concerned me was, are we throwing the net too wide, or are we really looking at chemicals that actually can come out of the medium that they're in and actually harm people? And the answer is yes. This is a thoughtful bill The focus is narrow, and the effort is not to regulate. It's not to, you know, jump the gun and get too far down the road. The effort, as I understand it from this bill, and I think I've gotten to the point where I understand it fairly well, is really to say what's out there that we should be looking at. Let's go out, as the senator, I think, said eloquently, you know, let's, at the state level, let's start doing some of this ourselves and go out and find out if there is a potential problem so that we can take that intelligence and then act more intelligently to try to deal with it if it is indeed a problem. And I appreciate the effort, appreciate you being here, and support the bill.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions or comments? We're going to leave this hearing open and go on to several other issues, and we'll be back. We'll be back to it when we get some other things out of the way.
Can I just make a note?
Jim, you're going to carry over 74.
Sure.
Paperwork stuff. Administrator?
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, just want to acknowledge that Debbie just passed around some submitted testimony only from Metro by Randy Tucker and also by Senator Rosenbaum for your files.
Thank you very much. I'm going to announce we are carrying over House Bill 4074 to Friday and House Bill 4128 to Friday. We have paperwork problems on those two bills. So if you're here to deal with those, we'll see you again on Friday. We have some work sessions. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 4046 and ask Madam Administrator to tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 4046 had a public hearing on the 6th, and again, public hearing and a possible work session. This was, you'll recall, the bill that excludes, for the purposes of the assessment on insurance premiums, accidental only specified disease or hospital indemnity insurance policies if the policies pay benefits on an indemnity basis. We have the Dash 1 amendments that we addressed on Monday that changes the effective date from what's in the current bill, July 1, 2013, to September 29, 2013. So you do have the Dash 1 amendments before you. We do have a fiscal and a revenue impact statement on the bill, Mr. Chair. We are ready to go.
Including on the Dash 1s, huh?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thompson, you have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/2/12.
Representative Thompson's moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/2/12. Is there any discussion? Those amendments simply put the time back so that it reduces the potential revenue impact. Is that what I understand? Is there any opposition? Amendments are adopted. Representative Thompson?
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 4046 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? I'd like to make a statement. I've been fighting this bill, as my colleagues from the DUC know, for some time. I'm still not comfortable with it, although I'm going to support it, because I do believe there are three kinds of health insurance. The question is whether the specific illness health insurance is really health insurance or it's not. My sense is there are three kinds of health insurance. There's service health insurance, where you sell a promise to provide service. There's indemnity health insurance, where you sell a promise to indemnify you if you have expenses in healthcare. And there's disease specific, which promises to give you a check if you get an illness. But I think there's been enough arguments. I think enough other people have been convinced. I know when you can get to 31, that's all you need. And yes, sir.
Chair, I was prepared for an eloquent speech on this bill, carried over from the session ago, but I am so overjoyed that you come from the dark side to the light side. I'm going to suspend any further discussion for fear you might retreat.
Representative Thompson, I hope this dispels all these rumors that you've been hearing about me for 10 years, that I'm inflexible.
We're moving the right direction.
Obviously not. Representative Daugherty?
Well, Representative Thompson, I might replace him on the dark side.
Oh, no.
No. I also, although I'm going to vote yes, have some concerns about this bill. And the reason is I think that the company that is involved, if you ask most of the people on the street whether that's a health insurance company, people will probably say yes. And so I think it needs to be made very clear, whether it's in marketing or whether it's in whatever, that people know this is not a health insurance company. And so, you know, that's kind of my concern. The assessment goes to good things. And, you know, so many of the programs that we have for kids, we keep chopping back and chopping back. And it's one thing about, you know, cutting back on programs for adults, but it's something else when you got kids. And so that's where, you know, I really have concerns about that. And that's why I wanted to voice these concerns that down the road this might be, there's going to be some confusion as to whether there's health insurance. So.
Representative Thompson,
Representative Daugherty, I understand your concern, but the issue before us, I think, is relatively clear. If the intent of the legislation is to raise money, and mm-hmm. I sympathize with the need, then we should also include Safeway, which has a pharmacy department that sells prescription drugs that are definitely health-oriented and Band-Aids. Mm-hmm. So if we take the healthcare thing too far, we can raise a lot of money. But this narrows it down to what the actual intent of the original legislation was. And I think quite clearly the case was made that Aflac was not part of that.
And I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? We have a motion on the floor for the...
We do, yes.
Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Daugherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinmer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Greenlee?
Aye. And the motion passes.
Don't
want to
carry it.
No. Who would like to carry this thing? Not including me or Daugherty.
I will do it.
Representative Thompson is the carrier.
Good. If anybody else wants to, that's okay. But
we're ready to go on.
Not everybody is in
line. 4127. Is that right?
Yes. It has a subsequent referral
to Ways and Means. Okay. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 4127. And Madam Administrator, will you tell us what we're doing here?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4127 requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt standards and procedures to certify specified mental health providers to qualify for insurance reimbursement, declares an emergency effective on passage. I believe that Representative Hoyle spoke to the Dash 1 amendment, which specify that the authority may adopt by rule an application fee or certification fee or both that can be imposed on any provider organization that applies for the certification. I do have all the paperwork, and I believe you folks have it in your meeting materials. There is a revenue impact of no impact on the Dash 1, and there is a fiscal impact statement issued on the Dash 1 amendment. This also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Did we adopt the Dash 1s last time?
Mr. Chair, I believe that was on another bill. That was on 4128 that we adopted.
I don't think we did.
Okay. I hear a motion.
First clarification.
Okay.
Yep. On the agenda item here, it says referral to revenue. Has that been switched?
Mr. Coach.
We're in 4127. Right? No,
I believe she's just looking at 4074, Mr. Coach.
Oh.
Yeah, we're talking about 4127,
okay.
Which is Ways and Means.
Okay. I was looking up, not down.
So I tried to keep that line straight. Anybody have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4127.
Dated.
Dated at some date that I'm about to be made aware of. 131 of 11.
Representative moves the Dash 1 amendments.
Well, 13112.
I hope so.
Yeah.
The next one amendment is to House Bill 4074, dated 13112. Is there any discussion on the amendments? The amendment? Any objection? The bill is amended.
Chair Greenlee, I move House Bill 4127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Is there any discussion?
Just a comment. A comment. As I said, this was a bill that is important to keep current services, specifically in our rural areas, within addictions and mental health, available to those who need it, because it allows for reimbursement of people who, although they may not have the appropriate accreditation, they have the experience to be able to provide those services. I will say that after this committee hearing, I spoke with some representatives from the insurance industry, and they did have concerns about quality and did state that they wanted to work on this to make sure that whatever changes we make did not result in an open-ended approval that would reduce quality. I'm very comfortable with this bill going down to Ways and Means. I am also very comfortable that regardless of the path of this bill, that we work with both the Addictions and Mental Health Services and the providers and the insurance agencies to ensure that we have the best quality people giving the right kind of treatment and that we're not reducing the options for addiction and mental health services specifically in our rural areas where we don't have access to the same kind of practitioners. So I just wanted to put that on the record that this was, that again, it is a complex issue, but it is something that we need to address, balancing the quality and access, but also making sure that we don't shut down that access because compensation isn't available for people doing the work. So just again, want to say that there are some valid issues, but committed either way that pass or fail, that we're going to work towards ensuring that the places that are delivering critical services will be able to continue to do that.
Thank you. Any other comments? Please call the roll.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnemer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye. House Bill 4127 is on its way to Ways and Means via the floor. I'm going to open a public hearing. Any questions? I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4122. Madam Administrator, what do we got? Do you have a sheet as well?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 4122 was the pharmacy benefit manager public hearing that we had on Monday. We carried over the remaining test witnesses that had signed up on it to complete that public hearing. This requires the pharmacy benefit managers conducting business in Oregon to obtain a license and annually renew the license with the State Board of Pharmacy. This, too, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Can I call forward Bill Cross, Ken Wells, and Mark Watt?
Is Tom in the room? He was supposed to come back.
Mr. Burns, are you here? I don't see him.
Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists and the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. And I know you heard at the hearing earlier this week about the prescription benefit managers, and what this bill would attempt to do. And it's our understanding that there may be a recommendation to do a work group on this. We would obviously be thrilled to participate in that. As our testimony will indicate, there have been some issues that have evolved over the years with the role that the prescription benefit managers have played. And they've been relied upon to reduce prescription drug costs, but they have become under increased scrutiny by the federal government and consumers who've questioned whether they're actually saving their clients money. We've outlined some of the areas where lawsuits have been generated and some of the settlements that have occurred in the last 5-10 years, and they raise some very disturbing issues in terms of health care and prescription benefit services. So we are pleased that the committee will consider this as we move forward into 2013. I would like to introduce two pharmacists who will maybe explore a couple of those issues as it affects pharmacies and their patients. Mark Watt and Ken Wells.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, and committee members. My name is Marcus Watt. I've been a pharmacist in Oregon for 34 years. I'm currently employed by Walgreens as the clinical pharmacy manager for their specialty pharmacy, which is located in Beaverton, Oregon. I served for 8 years on the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, serving 2 terms as president. I'm here today representing Walgreens and the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition to ask for your support of House Bill 4122. On Monday, I believe we all heard Anne-Marie speak about all the difficulties she encounters on a daily basis in regards to being able to serve her patients while making enough profit to keep her pharmacy open. I'd like to make the point that other than the geographical challenges that she faces, every pharmacy in the state faces many of those same challenges. It's simply a matter of scale and availability of alternate revenue sources that make it easier for other outlets to not have the same extreme of issues. It's one thing to keep the doors open when your prescription business is 4% of your total store sales. It's another thing when your prescription business is 60% or 70% of your total store sales. Across the country, PBMs manage over $90 billion in drug spending each year, and they do so in virtual secrecy. There exists no national regulatory oversight of this industry, and there are very few states that have any regulatory oversight either. I can think of no other participant in the healthcare delivery system that is not regulated in some way. Oregon even regulates tattoo artists and nail technicians, and yet we don't regulate the PBMs that deliver millions of dollars medications to our patients. I also found it interesting on Monday to hear the PBM representative state that they felt that the proper regulatory venue should be the Insurance Commission and not the Board of Pharmacy. Historically, when PBMs have been faced with regulation by insurance commissioners, their response has been that they aren't insurance companies and therefore they should not be regulated under that venue. PBMs negotiate in secrecy with pharmacy to provide prescription drugs to their members at rates that are typically at or below cost. They also negotiate separately with the insurance company to provide those services from the pharmacy without disclosing any specific payment information with the insurance company. In addition, they also negotiate discounts from drug manufacturers for increasing the utilization of their drugs. These discount amounts are not disclosed to anyone in the process, and while some of those rebates or discounts are shared back with the purchaser, it's common belief that that discount is typically kept by the PBM to improve their profitability. Rebate or discount activity often takes away from the physician's choice of therapy. It forces them to submit to prescribing the PBM's preferred product that has the largest discount, as opposed to the drug that may provide the best outcome for that patient. I think all of us have been to the pharmacy to get a prescription filled and been told, just a moment, we have to call a physician and see if we can get this changed for you. PBM transparency has been shown to save money for both consumers and health plans to cover them. There's several examples, one of which is Texas. Texas has to make the savings of $265 million by switching to a transparent PBM contract. Wisconsin saved over $30 million by switching to a transparent PBM. House Bill 4122 will allow regulatory oversight and transparency of PBMs, enabling payers and patients to more accurately assess their true health care costs, improve patient access to care, and allow them to make better, more informed decisions about their health care options. I respectfully ask for your support of House Bill 4122.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, and committee members, my name is Ken Wells. I reside in Junction City. I am a regional pharmacy manager with Safeway. I'm also a current member of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, but today I represent Safeway, my employer, and the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you in support of House Bill 4122. House Bill 4122 will provide transparency of the pharmacy benefit, or PBMs, so that disclosure of cost negotiations and rebate levels allow insurance companies to ensure they are not overpaying for the services provided by the PBMs, therefore decreasing the overall cost of insurance coverage. PBMs are entrusted with processing of billions of dollars of prescriptions in this country and currently have little to no regulatory oversight at the federal level or in Oregon, which is why this key legislation is necessary. Transparency does not lead to collusion, as the testimony was on Monday, but instead leads to savings and better patient care. Medco, Express Scripts, and Caremark are the three largest national independent PBMs and appeared before your committee on Monday. They have emerged from a decade of rapid growth and consolidation to cover a combined 190 million lives and manage a combined $90 billion in drug spending without regulatory oversight. Due to contracted rates, pharmacies are forced to either send their patients elsewhere to get their prescriptions or serve their patients and to spend the medications at small margins or at a loss. For your constituents, this means limited or decreased access to their pharmaceutical services. On July 1st of this year, Walgreens gave up an estimated $5.3 billion in annual sales nationally when it ended participation with Express Scripts because, in their analysis, the reimbursement rates were too low. A large majority of patients are mandated to order their maintenance medications and have it dispensed and distributed by mail, a service provided, in fact, by all three of these PBMs. Some patients have the option of using a local pharmacy, but they may be charged a higher copay than when using mail order. Many of your constituents are senior citizens, and this distribution by mail can be confusing, resulting in them getting their medications late or not at all, which can result in higher overall health care expenditures. Most of these are Medicare or Medicaid patients who receive multiple prescriptions, requiring additional interactions between the patients and their pharmacists. The community pharmacist is a key member of the overall health care team, there to do what is best for the patients. To ensure patient safety in the state of Oregon, the Oregon Board of Pharmacy is the ideal regulatory agency for the oversight of the PBMs. Using the PBM financial data, they can see if decisions are based on optimal care for the patient or for savings to the PBM and or insurer. Some examples would be the drug formularies. Are the drugs chosen for the greatest profit, or are they chosen for the greatest need for the patient? Drugs that are put on prior authorizations. Again, are we making it harder to serve the needs of that patient, or are we making it easier? Even today, we have brand name medications and generic products, and as all of you know, the brand name product is 99% always more expensive than the generic. But there are several PBMs that contract with the manufacturer, and we at the pharmacy level are required to dispense the name brand because the PBM gets a kickback from that. therapeutic interchange and therapeutic substitution, again, whether it be a class of heart medication, one manufacturer may give a greater rebate, and so that is the drug of choice on the formulary, as long as it's, quote, falls within that therapeutic substitution or class. Different MTM services, again, what is the reimbursement? Are we managing that therapy of that member and getting the proper medication? And something that I guess is transparent to the maybe to the patient, but it affects the pharmacies alone too, is the pharmacy audits, where a lot of times the pharmacies can dispense medications and 3 years later, over a technicality, are charged back for that service. So at a time when you're considering major healthcare transformation in Oregon, registration and disclosure of various practice and rebates and regulatory oversight by the Board of Pharmacy will ensure patient safety and provide health care savings for all Americans, all Oregonians. We ask for your support of House Bill 4122 and end the unregulated practice of the PBMs. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, since it sounds like you were here during the last hearing, what your thought was about whether the regulation should come under the Board of Pharmacy or perhaps under Department of the Insurance Division, DCBS?
Personally, I think that how it does intertwine directly with patient care, I feel it should be the Board of Pharmacy.
So then I think the suggestion was that it be under
DCBS,
not under the Insurance Commission, which is only one division of the business. Whatever is BCBS?
DCBS. Insurance
Department of Business.
Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Listen, if you can't get your acronym straight.
I can't do that.
That's alphabet soup.
I have one other question.
Yes, please.
For Mr. Watt, you stated some savings in Texas and I think Wisconsin, and I'm wondering, is that what the state saved for its portion, or is that the estimated savings for including private insurance?
I understand that was the state savings. We can provide you with the documentation
okay.
you'd like.
Thank you.
I would like to see those reports if you have them readily, Andy.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing.
Thank you.
And we're going to carry a work session over on this bill to Friday. We will be considering an amendment Friday, but likely we'll be moving this forward. There's great interest in this committee to work on this issue. We'll be working on the interim will be our most likely conclusion. But we do want to get an amendment from Representative Bailey and have it before the committee before we move on. So carry over work session on 4122. Let's open. Are we just doing a? This is the first public hearing, huh?
Correct.
Okay.
This was a carryover, sir.
Open up a public hearing on, on House Bill 4135. And Madam Administrator?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committees. House Bill 4135 comes before us at the request of Representative Frederick. It requires the insurer, if a rate filing represents a specified premium rate increase, to send notice to affected policyholders and persons who requested the notification. Requires the director to deny approval of the rate filing if the carrier reimburses claims for serious adverse events, and requires the director to consider specified criteria relating to financial condition of the insurer in approving rate increases.
Do we have the representative with us?
No.
Okay. Okay. Would you notify the representative's office that we're in a hearing on this now, if he wants to join us? Representative Frederick. Let's have the frequent flyers first. John Powell, Elise Brown, and Lisa Trussell.
Okay.
for it, team.
Frequent flyers. Good afternoon, co-chairs Greenlick and
Thompson.
You have
a gold card when you're frequent flyer.
Pardon me?
You have a gold card here when you're...
A gold card?
For, when you're frequent flyer.
For frequent flyers. Wow. Better live up to that. Members of the committee, Elise Brown, this afternoon representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and I'm joined by two of AHIP's Oregon members, Regents and HealthNet. You'll hear from them in just a bit. But I'm happy to be here this afternoon just to offer a couple comments in opposition to House Bill 4135. First of all, never events should never occur. And when they do, we shouldn't be paying providers who make mistakes. Medicare already has regulations in place, and private insurers are following the Medicare example in their contracts with providers now. So in other words, we're not paying for never events. For that reason, we feel that this bill is unnecessary, as the private market is already addressing this. We're concerned that the bill would lead to OID reviewing all provider contracts, and this would add more regulatory intrusion in our relationships with our contracted providers. What's more problematic in the bill is the requirements that are being included regarding additional rate regulation. Further regulation is unnecessary, as the Oregon Insurance Division is already taking very aggressive steps and processes to review rate filings, gathering public comment, including public hearings, and publishing all sorts of information for consumers to see. This bill sets an arbitrary limit of 7% to trigger all kinds of extra work and does nothing to add value to the processes that we already have in place. It seems that this would be a drain on taxpayer dollars, OID resources, as well as administrative expenses at the plan that would be better used for health care for our patients. So I'll turn it over to Regents and HealthNet, and then we'll be open for questions.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, Lisa Trussell representing HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon, and we're here also in opposition to House Bill 4135, and for the reasons that Ms. Brown already indicated, the Medicare took steps several years ago to stop payment for never events. The Oregon hospitals followed suit with making it a policy that they wouldn't bill for those. And provider agreements that now reflect that there won't be payment on never events for, I believe, most of the carriers. At least we have those in our contracts. The other thing with the rate filing and the notification requirements, for HealthNet, and we're a relatively small carrier in Oregon of the domestics, we're on the smaller side, and for us to do a mailing of a postcard recently just to notify of changes on our prior authorization list, it was a just direct cost $30,000. So if it's a letter, it would require, they were telling me to estimate double if it has to go in an envelope and in a letter format. And the 7% also is, I've not understood, this has been around previously, what the trigger of 7% is. It would seem that even PEB, which is self-insured, obviously, but PEB's trend has been over 7%. The last time I remember seeing something, it was about 11.8 or 10.8, which was roughly what the carrier's trends have been. So to have it so low, is we'd be sending out a mailing on probably virtually every filing. And for those reasons, we're opposed to the bill.
I thought Mr. Paul told us Regents had a 1.5% rate increase. All right.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chair, the only 1% or less a rate increase I'm aware of in recent times, I believe, was the Beaverton School District, who a year or two ago had a 0% because of their willingness to work with us in a health-related program. But
not the misremembered.
Yeah, I don't think so. We did recently put in a filing to reduce the previously approved small group rate, and that might be what you're remembering. We had filed a rate, and it was approved some time ago, in the middle of the term of that approval, our utilization was lower than we projected. And so we refiled in the middle of that term to reduce those rates. And that's been the process, I believe, approved. We've had the hearing on that. As previous witnesses have said, the insurance division has basically called for hearings on all rate filings. And we believe that that process is working and working well. It's a transparent process in which not only is our filing reviewed by others, but the insurance division is actually contracted with Osberg to review those filings and testifies to their findings as well. Troubling in this bill, co-chairs and members of the committee, is the timing. This bill would require us within 3 days of a filing to have each member notified by mail of our filing and the amount of that filing if it's over 7%. That is problematic in meeting that. Our actuaries work right up to the day of actually filing those to come up with the rate. And the longer they can take in that process to gather information on trend and utilization, the more accurate that rate can be. The more you back that timeline up in order to meet other regulatory matters, the higher the rate that they're probably going to propose simply because they don't have the information they would otherwise have. So we would object to the timeline of that notice. There are processes whereby interested citizens can get on a website and be notified when rate filings are made. There's a 30-day comment period afterwards. So there are processes that interested consumers can participate in this process and be notified now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question.
Representative Doherty.
When we come to rate notification, and I mean a lot of this, it's one thing when you send it to a policyholder that has 1,000 employees. I mean, that's something to plan for. But when you've got individual people, how much notice do you give them now as to what the rate increases are going to be? I don't know if there's an industry standard. Or
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Doherty, there's statutory timelines of how far in advance we're supposed to give notice. It's 30 days for a renewal of new rate. And carriers, previous to the starting of all the public hearings, many of us tried to give 45 to 60 days notice, but that's virtually impossible now because of the hearings involved. So 30 days is by statute.
Yes.
So if I'm an individual that doesn't make a whole lot of money and I have a policy, is that enough time for me to go through and try to find some sort of an alternative, or before, you know, I can dump one plan and get on the other?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Doherty, you know, it would be up to the person, of course, to do that. But I believe yes. You can call an agent or else go to einsurance.com. And we recently had to get insurance for my son and to shop all the carriers. Even though I'm employed by a carrier, I went to ehealthinsurance.com and they were all there, popped up with the premiums, the amounts of the deductibles, and the office copays. So it was very easy and it took me very little time. So I think it is. But there may be people that, I don't know.
It's just getting more and more difficult for people to, one, afford insurance, and two, to find it.
You can pass an exchange bill, and then you can make your
life. I'm thinking of my younger sister who lives in the state of Washington, who's looking very carefully at this, who literally is, you know, every month is going, how do I pay my insurance with my $5,000 deductible kind of thing. So.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Doherty, that is it's always an issue, and with costs rising as fast as they have in healthcare in the last few years, it's everybody's desire to give as much notice as possible. One of the problems we're having now is in the hearing process, after the rate is filed, there's a 30-day comment period. Then the insurance division actuaries and the others and the consultants they consult with review the filings, and there's give and take and additional information requested. And there is a timeline for the insurance division to meet. They're not meeting that in most cases now. I'm not being critical of them. They work very hard and they do the best job they can. But it's complicated from our side and it's complicated from their side. So we do the best we can mm-hmm. in getting that out, and then there is that statutory period. So if they don't get back to us, we have to wait to get that rate until that notice has been out.
Okay.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you very much. Can I call Representative Frederick? And maybe Laura after can join you, supporting you.
Thank you.
Sorry we went ahead without you.
That's all right. I was in the middle of something and rushing, trying to rush down there. So. Getting two steps at a time is a fun thing. Hello, I'm Representative Lou Frederick, members of the committee, co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson. I represent House District 43 in North and Northeast Portland, and I really want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on 4135. This regards health insurance rates, rate reviews, and approvals. Now, we know that middle-class Oregonians and small businesses struggle with the skyrocketing cost of health insurance. Through increased accountability and transparency, we can limit rate increases to those that are necessary and justifiable. Now, we took important steps beginning in the 2007 legislative session to shine the light of day on the rate review process. HB 4135 represents the next step. This bill does two common sense things. First, House Bill 4135 requires insurers covering more than 1,000 individuals to notify their policyholders by mail whenever they seek a rate increase of more than 7%, and to provide them with information about opportunities for public comment. For too long, those who pay these bills have been kept in the dark until the bills arrive. Second, the bill ensures Oregonians will not have to foot the bill when an adverse event occurs, for example, a surgical or medical error that results in a serious adverse outcome for the patient. House Bill 4135 provides that insurers seeking rate approval must guarantee that their plans will not reimburse providers for provider-caused serious adverse events, or allow providers they reimburse to bill subscribers directly for costs associated with such events that harm them. The language we use in the bill mirrors the provision included in House Bill 3650 in 2011, the health transformation bill we passed last session. Serious adverse events are medical procedures that can be described as unnecessary or accidental as identified by Medicare. Medicare does not pay for them, and starting in 2011, the Oregon Health Plan won't pay for them either. Why should privately insured Oregonians be on the hook paying either through their rates or directly for their own misfortune? That's the basic testimony on this particular bill. If you have questions for me, I'd certainly love to try to answer them for you.
The question, we had two comments from
yes.
the panel before you. One is, why the 7%? Is that a magic number? Where did that come from?
The 7% was a number that was decided after we looked at the kinds of rate increases that were taking place. And frankly, the 7% was something that we thought people would want to, anything over that would clearly have an adverse impact on the financial status of the folks who are getting that rate increase.
The other question they raised is, are never events charged by anybody anymore? I mean, part of the thing is that the hospitals have agreed not to charge for never events.
This is trying to clear up some areas that were simply left out in the last effort. So that's what this is not. This is some do not, others do, and we're trying to clear that up right now.
Any other questions? Thank you. Laura?
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm a healthcare advocate at OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan consumer organization. And we are in support of this bill. think it's a good sort of common sense next step in a couple of different areas on the never events approach. As you've heard, this is largely in practice now, and that's a good thing. Having that fact be codified in the bill makes sense to create a level playing field for all the different providers and insurers, and I think it helps to send a clear signal to the provider community together with the differences happening in Medicaid and Medicare across the whole system, saying let's move toward putting measures in place that help prevent these terrible activities from happening that no one wants. They just cause money, and it's time to move on from them. So on that piece, on the notification of potential rate hikes, this is an interesting one, and it's Oregon's rate review system is quite good. It's not perfect. It's continually improving. But in our analysis of it, it's really quite a good system. And one thing that we're seeing and hearing a lot from consumers and small businesses is that while they appreciate the fact that the rate review process is more transparent now, rate filings are up online, people can comment as part of them, you can go to a public hearing and comment on rate filings. People also are very appreciative that they hear that they're going to get, if they're going to get a rate, once the rate has been approved, they get notification, you know, at least 30 days before actually being hit with those higher expenses, gives them some time. Those are very important. One thing that we are hearing from busy families, busy small businesses is, you know what, I really don't know about what exactly rate I'm going to see until I get that notice and it's already been decided. My opportunity to say what it means to me, my opportunity as a business owner trying to afford coverage, as a family trying to afford coverage, it's over. It's been decided. I'm getting notification to take out my checkbook and figure out how we're going to pay the additional rates or go shop around. And Oregon has a really, I think, a model process in terms of giving opportunities for consumers and businesses to engage, not just at the point where they need to either pay the price or go shop, but engage in the decision about what really is a reasonable rate and what's the impact of that rate going to be on them. This bill would help to notify consumers of the potential rate increase that they could see, and how they can get involved in the process before it's too late. I want to call your attention to a specific piece in the bill, and it basically it's a really well thought out provision is notifying consumers not just what the average rate increase would be. So the average rate increase might be 8%, but what the range is. And this is something that's very interesting when you look at rate increases. Maybe the average might be 8, but the minimum that someone might see might be -5. The maximum you might see might be 25%. That tells a very different story, and that really gives someone an idea of what the potential range might be for them. Now, clearly what would be even better is if consumers could get notification from insurers of what exactly their rate would be if this rate were approved, you know, if that rate were in effect today for them. That would be even better. That might be too onerous to do on such a tight time frame, we understand, and this is probably a good compromise in that realm. And if the consumer, you know, takes the time and goes on to the DCBS site where they can look at the rate filing, they can pour through about 500 pages of rate tables, they can figure out what their rate would be. It's a little challenging. But just to have that opportunity to be able to see what that rate increase might mean for them and to get engaged when they still have a chance for their engagement to matter, I think that's a good idea. And that's, I think, all for me. Good pill, good bill should pass.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for bringing it to us. We are probably going to carry the work session over. Somebody has an amendment proposed, and we're going to take a look at that amendment as well. So at least it won't die today.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Lou Savage, please.
Good to see you. I'm not Teresa Miller, and I know that disappoints you.
It sure does. Actually, we missed her in the state, I think.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the acting administrator for the Insurance Division, which is a division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today just really to provide you with some information about the two provisions of the bill that we have some involvement in. And let me just say, I do want to respond to Mr. Powell's comment. To my knowledge, we are on schedule with our rate review. That in the past, there may have been delays, but we are on track. The one area that we are working on, which is very difficult, is the long-term care rates. And Oregon is really a small piece of the national problem and picture on that. So there are some challenges with approving long-term care rates. But with respect to individual and small group markets, unless somebody can tell me differently, we are on track. So I wanted to let you know about that. With respect to the notice provision, we're a consumer protection agency. It would be hard for us to say that more notice is a bad thing. But really what I wanted to point out to you is what consumers would be directed to, and that's the web page that we have put together over the last year, which really does provide consumers with a tremendous amount of information. They have the opportunity to sign up for notification about rate increases or rate requests. There is a video that takes them through the rate review process. There's a public hearing schedule and information on how to comment. And we will start streaming our hearings beginning February 24th. So what they, meaning consumers, have available to them is really pretty robust, and we're pretty proud of that. So the only thing I would point out with respect to the bill itself is the notice does not specify how this would take place, whether it would be oral, written, or electronic, and that's certainly something that you'd want to take a look at. The other portion of the bill, is what we refer to as the never events clause, is again something that we would be involved in if the bill passes, because it would be included in their insurer's rate filing. What I've handed out to you is the hospital acquired conditions list, and that is referred to in the bill. The interesting thing about the bill at this point is that it applies to all providers, but it refers to the hospital-acquired provision conditions list. So the question is, if it doesn't take place in the hospital, you're referring to a hospital-acquired condition. How broad is this with respect to events that happen outside the hospital? That's really the question. With respect to our role in this, it really is not a huge role, because we review rate requests now for individual and group policies. In that respect, it's not a big burden for us. The real question is, what's the scope, is it going to improve healthcare? And we actually think it would. But again, with respect to the bill itself, we're neutral on the bill.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Well, thank you very much for coming. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4135, and carry over the work session until Friday, in case we want to reopen it on Friday. I will
who's the list of it?
Oh, it's just Representative Woodson.
Okay.
And then these guys. 4027.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4027. Representative Wisnet will be here shortly. Representative Wisnet is here already. And also ask David Sugarman and Nancy Sellers to join the panel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, co-chairs. Got two bills we're testifying to this. Thank you very much. I'm State Representative Gene Wisnet, House District 53. Chairs Thompson and Greenlick and honorable colleagues, thank you for allowing me to testify today on House Bill 4027. I sincerely appreciate the cooperation and support of the chairs to help this little bill stay alive. The committee worked this bill last session and sent it to rules where it died. The opposition position was that the bill is not required. The professionals providing this service, the services this bill desires, believe the bill is required. I've given you some talking points that came to me from Central Oregon Veterans Outreach people on the bill, and I thought the chair's intention today was that Mr. Chuck Hemingway will be here Friday, that I'd ask you to carry this over till Friday so he can be here to testify on these points. Mr. Hemingway runs our Central Oregon Veterans Outreach Program that goes into homeless camps and specifically looks at veterans, but we're I help anyone that's living in. We have too many people living in these homeless camps. They have a van, and they also take medical people, and that's what brings forth this bill. But the professionals providing the service, I spoke to some of them at a lunch the other week, and they really believe this bill is necessary. I know that the opposition thinks that it's covered somewhere else, but it really, they don't, we need them to say, feel comfortable to do the service, or we're not going to be able to help these people in special need. If the bill keeps dragging on, we're looking at a winter now, and if we don't come back till 2013 to address this, then we're looking at another winter. So I hope we can find a solution. I know that Mr. Hemingway has been talking to Mr. Sugarman. We had an email problem that didn't get, he didn't get some of our comments, and here's some. But I hope that the committee will appreciate, again, as I said, you're hearing the bill. I hope we can find a solution and make this happen this session so we can help those people, those needy people that are living in homeless camps and other type of activities. And I hope you'll carry it forward to Friday and have a work session and pass the bill. And I'm available for questions, but as I said to the chairs, I'm hoping, you know, and I'll try to stay and listen. I've got to come chair in the committee next door, but here's some of the opposition.
All right, glad we could find you. Mr. Sugar?
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Wisnet. David Sugarman, I am the co-chair of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association Legislative Committee. You know, let's be clear about some stuff. The goals of these folks are laudable. We fully support what they do. I do a lot of work in my private practice for veterans, and the need is unending. Immunity always gets me a little bit nervous, and I go back to the situation I'm in representing Oregon National Guard, Army National Guard veterans against Kellogg, Brown, and Root. These men were exposed to toxic chemicals while serving in Iraq at the Karmat Ali Water Treatment Plant. This body dealt with that and set up a fund for these troops. And KBR's initial response in litigation pending in U.S. District Court in Portland is, we're immune. And then their second response, a different form of immunity, was to say, well, okay, maybe we're not immune, but the U.S. government's on the hook. Now, the problem with that is this is absolutely not to equate the two. They're different in kind. But the problem with immunity in general is that it shifts responsibility. And what we have is a situation in which we want to balance the need to get services to these veterans and other homeless people, but we also want to make sure that we're not creating a two-tier justice system. Under the bill, as I understand it and as I read it, for example, if a family loses their home to foreclosure and they go live at brother-in-law's house and maybe at a friend's house, they are homeless as defined by federal statute, and that is the statutory definition used in HB 4027. And if that same family puts their kids in the Boys and Girls Club program for after-school care, and those kids are injured, for example, by a van driver who is driving, is speeding, or worse, the kids are without a remedy. And respectfully to these people who are doing what many would call God's work in the camps, who we support, there is a lot of protection for them under the Federal Volunteer Protection Act. We always come back to this problem of, well, perception is everything. We don't perceive that there's protection. But ultimately, we see this as an educational problem. We're talking, and I did eventually get a chance to connect with Mr. Hemingway, and part of this, I think, is a difference in just how we view the world, but no one should understand this to be anything other than good people thinking about how the world should be. Our view of this is justice for everybody, not a two-tier system, their view being expediency. Any questions? Happy to answer them.
Let's get, oh yes.
First of all, it's my understanding that a bill like this would not exempt gross negligence.
Representative Thompson?
Should not.
And Representative Greenlee, yes. There is a carve-out for intentional tort or gross negligence. That is correct. So, for example, let's take the horror situation where the van driver is, in fact, a sexual predator. Okay. That intentional conduct by itself is probably immunized. Now, just so we're clear, the supervisor who hired that person without screening, okay, under this bill, exempt, as I read this, okay? And again,
I thought this only applied to volunteer work.
Well, volunteer van driver, but the...
But the supervisor...
Well, that's a good point, Representative Green. Look, if the supervisor is, in fact, an employee, then you're right. That does not... I'm sorry, the supervisor would have to be a volunteer as well. That's correct. Thank you.
One of the things that came up was the question, the relationship between a charitable corporation and a charitable organization. Would somebody help me understand, is there a difference? And if there is not a difference, why is it necessary to change what's in the existing statute?
Would you like to answer that? Shall
no, I represent you? I paid for your legal advice.
Well, thanks. We should talk.
He volunteered on that, and therefore he's not.
Yeah, I was going to say volunteer. Representative Greenlee, that's also one of our problems. Charitable organization is, as far as we can tell, quite a bit broader than a charitable corporation. And we had that concern with the prior version, the 2011 House Bill 3019. I will be direct with you. That is a concern to us. It is not the biggest. The biggest is straight out immunity. And just so we're clear, I think I have a problem with the fact that it's not very well defined.
But straight out immunity, you're saying these people are already immune.
Well, they are within limits. For example, the Federal Volunteer Protection Act provides immunity to volunteer workers of any kind. But it does require, for example, that you have an auto insurance policy in place. Okay, so the van driver hypothetical where driver is speeding, taking the kids who are in, volunteer van driver, speeding, taking the kids in the after-school program who qualify as homeless, has a crash, insurance should be in place under the federal statute. Okay, not necessarily going to be in place here if volunteer is immune. Now, the physicians and medical providers have much broader immunity under existing statutory law, and that was something we explored in a lot of detail the last go-around on this deal. And as I understand from Mr. Hemingway, the concern about that is that there's something about they're doing outreach and that's not medical care. But, and I'm I don't want to mischaracterize what he's saying, and my colleagues can correct me if I don't quite have his point. We've had some quick emails back and forth.
Well, we are going to carry the public hearing at least over until Friday and we can explore it.
Thank you.
Again,
Mr. Chair, if I may add, I think Mr. Sugarman's comments, I appreciate that, because I thought that organization, charitable, and was a big issue, and if we can move past that, hopefully we can find, and I'm going to be sure that if Mr. Sugarman will keep working, Mr. Hemingway, we can try to find a solution to this to bring back to you, and I appreciate, again, you keeping it alive.
Good. Okay. Sellers.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to sit here before you as Executive Director of the Board of Optometry. My name is Nancy Sellers, and I am here neutral on the bill. The board has not taken a formal stand, but they were supportive in our discussions on Friday of expanding the list of healthcare professionals to include doctors of optometry. They do seem to fit into the other group that is there, but also to assure you that regardless of whether there is legal liability, the Oregon Board of Optometry would as aggressively pursue any complaints of negligence, incompetence, consumer complaints by these patients, whether or not the doctor of optometry had been paid or it was done voluntarily, and we would be able to pursue those actions against any doctor who was not performing services to the standards that we set forth in rule and law. And as long as we're able to continue doing that, the board has no objection to the bill.
Thank you.
Question before Representative Wisnett leaves.
Yes.
The one question, and I remember this bill from last year, is, and the question I had, I can't remember how far we went in the process, was where do the providers think that they're not covered? I mean, I know that there's a Good Samaritan kind of law, and maybe this is something, one of those questions that we can continue working on.
Chairs and Representative Doherty, that was a big issue that the trial attorneys felt that it was covered and this was not necessary. But in all my conversations with the people in Central Oregon that are trying to do this, the doctors felt no, and these other outreach people too said no, it needed to be in this documentation separate, would help them so much better. And I think we may even get one of those doctors or human resources to come over and talk about that.
We'll get them on the phone too.
On Friday, yes.
We do it by phone too.
Okay, but they can come over too.
Will you be back on Friday?
Representative Greenlick, it depends on the time. I know I have a number of things scheduled. Does the committee know what time scheduled hearing would be?
Well, we can schedule it however we need to.
It would be much easier for my existing schedule if we could do it in the morning.
Oh, no.
No, we can't. No, we have sometime between 1 and 3.
1 to 3.
Okay. All right. Well, then I will rearrange my schedule and be here.
I appreciate that.
I have a follow-up for something for Friday.
Yes, go ahead.
And I think also the definition of where the current law says corporation versus charity. Because, I mean, there are lots of really, really good charities.
Versus organization.
But yes. There are some charities that are, and so if we could get a definition as to what it is, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Yes, Representative Thompson.
Since we're carrying this over, a couple of specific instances I just want to lay out for you to think about, and we can talk about on Friday. In one case, we had a dentist here in Salem who was on maternity leave and with time on her hand, and was willing to donate that time to the Boys and Girls Club, where there is a professional dental suite in place. And that was impeded by the need for her to supply $700 worth of liability insurance to the Boys and Girls Club in order to be able to be a volunteer. Now, that happened, but that's a chilling effect. And if, in fact, that didn't need to happen, we need to find a much clearer way to state that, because the relationship between some of the charities and some of the, in this case, medical providers, is not clear. And the other one that has come up recently is we're involved with a free clinic setup held at a church in Dallas, and we're soliciting physicians to donate time to that. There is no problem getting nurses and physicians to donate their time. The problem is, how are they covered for liability or not? And if they are covered or if they are immune, it is not obvious.
Yeah.
So we need some vehicle mechanism to say who's in and who's out and why, and quit this, go ahead and spend a lot of money on liability insurance that you may not need if, in fact, you don't need it. in order to volunteer, because we need these volunteers. If immunity is the direction we need to go, I think that addresses Representative Wisnant's question, then we need to find a way to get there. If we don't need to go there because we've done it, then we better find another way to state that we've done it, that it ain't happening.
Representative Thompson, shall I respond briefly?
Please, if you
very briefly, please. Thank we you. Have another hearing. We
sorry.
Have
the sale
several
of
witnesses here.
The sale of insurance is a separate issue, but the immunity is in place. We can talk about it on
okay.
committee.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to carry over public hearing and a possible work session on on House Bill 4020, House Bill 4027, and close this public hearing. And I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4123. We have about 20 minutes left and about 8 witnesses to go, so I'm going to ask you all to be brief. We have 3 who say they've come from more than 100 miles, and if that's true, I'd like to start with them. Tim Schester, Joe Gregorich, and Patricia Aline. So if we can start with the 3 of you, and again, ask you to be brief. 2 of you are opposed to the bill and 1 in favor. And then I'll try and balance it in a different way from now on. Please, 2 to 3 minutes at most.
If you can get quiet.
Can go?
Sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Can she start?
Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Thompson and Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Pat Aline, and I'm currently the chair of the Community Health Committee of the Oregon Medical Association. I recently retired from, after 34 years of private practice from Springfield Family Physicians. I currently also still have an active Oregon medical license and recertified board recertified last year. I'm testifying in favor of support of House Bill 4123. It requires the OHA to maintain a list of designated high-priority chemicals of concern that relate to children's health and are used in children's products. Over the past few decades, and more recently accelerating, thousands of chemicals are incorporated into household consumer products, including children's products. Because of their size, physiology, including their metabolic state and their behavior, crawling around on the floor and eating little tidbits of things, they are more vulnerable to products. The bill, the OMA supports the creation of the OHA website that will monitor the potential exposure to toxic chemicals. It allows the public access to reliable information so they may be aided in making informed choices. This is a step toward full disclosure of product ingredients. The bill also allows the OHA to participate in the Interstate Clearinghouse. This is an association that provides high quality and authoritative data on chemicals to states, organizations, and the public. This will hopefully foster the safer use of chemical products and encourage development of safer alternatives. We hope this will foster competition in creating new affordable products. I chair the OMA Community Health Committee, which has continually supported Oregon's legislative efforts to protect the public and particularly children from harmful chemicals. In recent years, the OMA supported the BPA bill. Products that contain chemicals, like BPA, even in small doses, are suspected of causing chronic disease, cancer, and infertility. We believe this legislation represents a sound approach to managing Oregon's efforts in this arena, aligning with other states and building off work already done by the Department of Environmental Quality is a pragmatic and more efficient means of identifying chemicals of concern. We will continue to monitor research that is being done by such entities as the National Institute of Environmental Health, EPA's Centers for Children's Environmental Health and Disease Prevention Research. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you today and could take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lynn. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, you're the only two listed in opposition. I'll give you a little more time.
Great, thank you.
2 minutes if you need it, but not a lot more.
Understood. Thank you, Co-Chair Greenlee. Co-Chair Thompson, my name is Tim Shestick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. Our members are leading manufacturers of chemical products. We do share the objective of the sponsors. A safety of our products is our top priority. In our view, if we didn't believe our products were already safe for their intended use, frankly, we wouldn't be making them. We've reviewed the provisions of House Bill 4123, and we have concerns on several fronts, but three primarily. The first is that the bill has this underlying premise that children's products contain chemicals that pose a risk to the health of children. Secondly, we believe the bill is falsely presumed on the assumption that the presence of any identified chemical means the product is somehow harmful. And finally, we believe that the bill gives a false impression that the array of regulatory programs in place governing chemicals and consumer products is somehow inadequate. Just on that second point, in terms of the bill being presumed to be the presence of identified chemical at any level should be a cause of concern. For any chemical, natural or synthetic, the degree of toxicity and the potential for harm is dependent upon the dose and exposure. Federal government agencies, including US EPA, the Centers for Disease Control, readily acknowledge that the mere presence of a chemical substance in the environment, in the human body, or in consumer products does not equate to the risk of harm. As drafted, the bill, in our view, would simply result in a list of chemicals that are present in certain children's products without any corresponding information for the public or for regulators as to what that information means, or perhaps more importantly, what that information doesn't mean. Compiling a list of chemicals is not the same as conducting a scientific evaluation on how those chemicals are used, in what quantities, and whether they may pose an unreasonable risk. In our view, regulatory programs that do not ensure this type of information is communicated accurately and in the context run the risk of generating, in our view, unnecessary fear and hysteria that is not supported by scientific fact. Finally, before turning it over to Mr. Gregorich, I would just add that any suggestion or allegation that chemicals or products are somehow produced or marketed without regulatory oversight, in our view, is not the complete picture. There are more than a dozen federal laws in place regulating the safety of chemicals in commerce, not just TSCA, the Toxic Substance Control Act, but a host of others that I believe Mr. Gregorich is going to touch on. I would ask that the committee also take a look, and the state of Oregon also take a look at what's happening at the federal level in terms of US EPA and their work to enhance, if you will, their kind of oversight of chemicals and chemical products. They're in the process of developing a candidate list of priority chemicals for potential further review, and they're also in the process of producing under a new, what's called the new chemical data reporting rule that went into effect February of 2012. So not only the public, but other government regulators and others are going to have access to a whole host of information about chemicals, their production, their use, and I think Oregon can benefit from at least taking a look at that information before going down the path of creating a new regulatory scheme that we think is problematic. So with that, we are currently opposed to the bill. Appreciate the opportunity to make these comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, my name is Joe Gregorich. I'm with the Toy Industry Association, and we are here today in opposition to HB 4123. I want to begin by echoing the comments of Mr. Shestick and putting those on the record as well for TIA. And I just want to start off by saying that toy safety and children's safety is TIA and our members' number one priority, and we do want to commend this committee and the sponsors of this bill for their interest in ensuring the safety of the children in Oregon. TIA is a national nonprofit trade association representing roughly 500 toy manufacturers, retailers, distributors, and vendors across the country. In Oregon, the toy industry employs over 3,000 Oregonians and has a rough economic impact of over $800 million to the state. And so, as Mr. Shestick has said, toys that are sold in the United States are very heavily regulated at the federal level. In 2008, Congress passed the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which regulates toy safety and creates a toy safety standard that includes chemical safety and other safety standards relating to the safety of products. In addition to the CPSIA that was, again, passed in 2008, toys sold in the United States have to comply with the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Child Safety Protection Act, Federal Hazardous Substances Act, the American Society for Testing and Materials, ASTM, that is the standard for toys that is made federally mandatory by CPSIA, and then the Toxic Substances Control Act. So as you can see, there are a host of federal regulations that we must comply with, and every single toy that is sold on the shelves in the United States and in Oregon has to certify that we are in compliance with the CPSIA. So we feel that this program is duplicative and would create an overly burdensome program for the industry in Oregon and the state of Oregon itself. And so for those reasons, we do remain opposed to the bill, and I'm here to answer any questions that you might have.
You both recognize this wouldn't regulate anything. And the bill has no regulatory effect, right?
It would require companies that sell children's products to report substances in their products. So with that, it would regulate us to require us to do that.
Representative Thompson?
How would a toy manufacturer in Germany shipping toys through the port of New York to be sent to several distributors in various parts of the country have any knowledge whether or not their toys were going to end up in Oregon?
The industry, from my understanding, does rely on a network of distributors and whatnot. But you are right. When you are shipping to a global scale, you have to products will be manufactured to a certain standard, and that's why certain times states acting specifically can be a detriment to an industry that operates on a global scale. So we would prefer, and again, and so to back up, in 2008, the state of Washington did pass similar legislation. Our response to that, we did support federal legislation that was signed in by President Bush and updated by a bill this year by President Obama, and we supported both of those bills.
Sure.
And in the same vein, if a toy company in China were to import toys into this country through the port of Seattle, and they were trucked from Seattle to San Francisco coming through the state of Oregon, would they have to register because they're trucks coming through Oregon, or is this only for toys that would actually hit the shelves in Oregon?
I would have to get back to you on that, but I believe it would be toys sold in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you both very much. It's come for a long way.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just a question. I guess I'm not clear who put this bill together, and I had a question. I don't know that you can answer it. I wondered why in the list of exclusions of non-toys some items are included.
The sponsor who's sitting
on this committee. Well, I asked that earlier, and they suggested that maybe I ask someone else. And
others are coming.
Others are coming. Yeah. Excuse me. I thought this was the final panel.
All right. Thank you very much. No, we have six more people. We have 6 minutes to do it in or something. So let's start with Renee Hackenmiller, Quanda Griffith, and Gail Shibley. Brief, please. Said maybe Gail. You can take another half an hour of the 5 minutes we have left.
Problem solved.
I'm just kidding. Maybe we'll steal 5 minutes more because we have three other people yet.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Renee Hackenmiller Paradis, and I am the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. The Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 413 to designate a list of high priority chemicals of concern for children's health and have the Oregon Health Authority collect data on the presence of these designated chemicals as ingredients in children's products sold in Oregon. HB 4123 is good public health policy that provides OHA with the necessary tools to effectively protect the health of Oregonians by reducing exposures to hazardous substances that may be encountered by children every day. In 2010, the President's Cancer Panel confirmed that toxic chemical exposure is an important risk factor for cancer. In 2007, cancer cost Oregon $2.6 billion in health care, lost productivity, and diminished earning potential. Toxic exposure is also a risk factor for birth defects and neural behavioral disorders. Exposures in early childhood can create risk later in life. And we know that chemicals linked to disease, including cancer, are found in consumer products and in our bodies. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention biomonitoring studies regularly find several hundred toxic chemicals in our body. And according to the CDC, sources of exposure include using products with chemicals in them or products stored in containers made with the chemicals. Yet chemical ingredient information is not fully disclosed to consumers or health officials. You've heard that early childhood exposure is a critical period for preventing toxic exposures. The brain and body are most vulnerable to chemical exposures during critical windows of development. And we know from scientific studies that chemicals don't always stay in the products they're put in. The studies from the CDC confirm this. And we know that the natural habits of children being on the floor, putting everything in their mouths, gumming, sucking, and teething behaviors, these all contribute to children having higher exposures to potentially harmful chemicals. In addition, the immature metabolisms of children means that their bodies are often less able to remove harmful substances from their bodies. In the last two decades, we've seen significant increases in the occurrence of cancer, including all childhood cancers. And there's no doubt that one effective tool to prevent childhood cancer and some other cancers that occur later in life is to eliminate exposures to cancer-causing substances. We can have the greatest impact on improving our population's health if we address the exposures that occur when people are most vulnerable in infancy and childhood. But first, we must understand where, when, and how exposures to potentially harmful chemicals occur, and this is what this bill sets out to do. That will allow us to prioritize exposure reduction efforts and focus limited resources on interventions that can result in the greatest improvements to our children's health. The information obtained through HB 4123 provides data to OHA that could be used to determine which children's products are of concern, fully assess potential exposure pathways for a prioritized small list of chemicals.
I suggest you don't need to read all of your written testimony.
So specifically, we've heard what 4123 does. I've laid it out in my written testimony there. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer those. I will specifically address Representative Kenemer's question about why there's the inclusion of those specific products in the bill. This bill is modeled after what Washington passed in 2008. And to keep it consistent with what they have already done and reporting that will be implemented as of August 2012, we work to keep it as close to Washington's bill as possible. As you'll see, there's a provision in there for data sharing amongst states to not create redundancies within the system. So hence, we wanted to make our bill as comparable to Washington's as we could. And that's the real reason for that list of exemptions. As a broader way, most of those things that are exempted are not things that children will be putting in their mouths. Small children, I hope, are not using some of those products. And so those why those are explicitly called out as exempted.
So. Mr. Chair, although they do wear athletic shoes, for example, and I would think that creates that contact. And so I just, or...
It's the Nike exemption.
Slings and... Oh. maybe that's a good answer. Thank you.
And I also, I agree with the representative from the ACC that the mere presence of a toxic chemical does not mean that it's going to cause harm. That's what this bill is really setting out to do, is give us the information that we need to look at this and assess those exposures so that we can make informed public policies as we move forward. It's not restricting anything. It's asking to tell us what's there so that we can look and see if there is stuff that we need to look more deeply at. So the Oregon Environmental Council urges your support of HB 4123 as a step toward reducing preventable exposures to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. And I'm happy to take any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Griffin.
Co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Cassandra Griffin. I'm the policy manager with Upstream Public Health, a statewide organization working to improve the health of all Oregonians. Most of us can agree on two points. We should protect kids from the worst toxic offenders, and families have the right to know what toxic chemicals their children are exposed to. All of us Oregonians are exposed to harmful toxins every day where we work, live, study, and play, often through consumer products. Children and pregnant women are particularly vulnerable to the health impacts associated with those exposures. This bill is a common sense approach. It would set up a science-based approach to disclose information about the most critical toxins of concern. House Bill 4123 is a step toward getting families the information they need to make safety determinations on the toxins their children are exposed to from the products and toys they use.
the risks are too great not to act. Lead poisoning, asthma, cancer, and developmental disabilities are all linked to toxin exposure in the United States. Those result in illness, suffering, and an annual price tag of more than $54 billion. Therefore, reducing exposures to harmful toxins is essential to ensuring the health and economic security of our communities. Other states are taking leadership roles by creating policies to reduce unnecessary and dangerous toxins in everyday products, and at least to let us know when they are there. Washington, Maine, Minnesota, and California have all recently passed such laws. Upstream Public Health believes it's a moral imperative for the state to equip parents with the information necessary to be informed about their children's safety. We ask this committee to take the first step and pass House Bill 4123. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Shibley, welcome.
Thank you very much, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I mostly wanted to be here and available for any questions today. This bill does affect the Oregon Health Authority and presumably my parts or part of the statute. Those of you who have heard me talk about health risk, environmental health risk before, are familiar with the concept of hazard times exposure equals risk, and the two components of that health risk we attempt to address. And in my our examination of this bill looks as though House Bill 4123 zeroes in on those chemicals that are found on both Oregon's and Washington's list of priority chemicals. Each of those lists, I understand, were generated by extensive public as well as scientific process, and is based on what is known about a chemical's toxicity, including its tendency to bioaccumulate and how long it persists in the environment. Regarding exposure, and there have been a couple comments made about this, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention periodically test a random sample of those that they survey on nutrition and health status. And by survey, I mean they take blood and urine and run it through a gamut, and they now have come out with their fourth report of a total of about 212 environmental contaminants. And my quick look at the overlap of the Oregon and Washington list, what I'm calling the overlap list between the Oregon Washington chemical list and that report from the CDC, indicates that most of them have been detected in most children. Formaldehyde, more than 50% of children 6 through 11, bisphenol A, at least 50%, since they only do it in that kind of percentiles. I think the percentage is actually much higher. The bottom line is that we believe we know that the incidence of exposure is fairly widespread. Exactly how children are being exposed is really an important but unanswered to date. Anyway, question. Currently in Oregon and most other jurisdictions, we have no mechanism to obtain information about which human-made chemicals or chemicals in general are most prevalent in products that are... We have no mechanism to obtain information about which chemicals are most prevalent in products that are designed, marketed, and sold for children. I must note that this bill does have a fiscal impact on our agency. The bill does allow the Oregon Health Authority to receive gifts, grants, and contributions from any public or private entity. However, until we receive resources to implement the bill, we would not be able to do so. Happy to answer any questions, and I very much appreciate this committee's leadership on protecting children's health.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Well, so you started to get down the path of fiscal impact. How many FTE do you think you would need to manage something of this scope?
Well, but Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Parrish, a ballpark estimate, depending on, there are a couple different pathways that you could go through. Some of them maybe involve putting together a data system. Some of them involve data sharing agreements and so on, but we ballpark all together about one FTE.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Can I ask you why you just can't put the Washington list up on your website right now? Saying this is the Washington list?
I suppose, I'm not quite sure I'm understanding your question.
There is a list in Washington, right?
There's a list of chemicals.
That were related to the very similar statute in Washington. They responded by putting a list up on their website. Is there anything to stop you from putting whatever that list is up on our website?
Mr. Co-Chair, not particularly, except it wouldn't have any germaneness to Oregon. I mean, it's a Washington
That's true.
State
Washington's
list.
Completely different physiologically, I understand.
I'm just not understanding your question. If you want us to put a list of chemicals up, why wouldn't we put up DEQ's list? Then,
all right. Why wouldn't you put up DEQ's list?
But that's actually not, or rather, if what you're asking, put up the list of chemicals or put
this
up the list of
This bill is intending to
effects?
Ask you to do something, right?
Correct.
Which is basically to put up some notes about chemicals.
Among other things, that's correct.
Among other things. But could you do that right now by taking somebody else's list and just putting it up? Doing whatever the intent of this bill is.
Yes. We'd figure out a way, maybe kind of, sort of, to be as responsive as we could. Of course, anytime either of those other two lists changed, we would have to know so that we could be sure to change and, you know, monitor that and so on. So there
Absolutely.
Are some issues around that.
All right. We do need to get out of here. We've got another committee coming in. Let me apologize to Ms. Chapman and
Vanetta
and Palmas. If you could please submit written testimony, that would be great. We've run out of time. I will close the public hearing and adjourn the House Committee on Health Care.